Coddersill's kickoff. This is Radio City Talk.
My guest for the next 45 minutes is former Liverpool Spurs England striker Paul Stewart, who's just got a brand new book out, Damaged, My Story. Very good morning to you, Paul. Great to see you on the tower.
Thank you very much.
No view of the city with all this fog around here. Not quite as you remember it, I would imagine, from your short spell at Liverpool.
No.
Have you got fond memories of that short spell at Liverpool?
I'd have to say probably not fond memories.
No.
To be honest, I didn't achieve what I wanted to achieve there. I think most Liverpool fans know that. I guess in a way, I probably do owe the club and the supporters somewhat of an apology, really, because what they should have been getting was a player at the peak of his career, just broke into the England squad, and what they ended up with was probably someone that was fighting demons and probably just in self-destruct mode. So I did say that when I joined Liverpool, I would have walked on broken glass to join the club. And that remains the same. But I just was fighting my own demons. And you know, for that reason, I didn't quite achieve what I would have loved to have achieved with the club.
What was it, a dream for you to join Liverpool Football Club? Yeah. How did it come about?
Well, I was doing well at Spurs. I'd scored a goal in a cup final. I'd broke into the England squad. And, you know, there were teams looking at me. Liverpool, you know, as I remember as a kid, dominated the scene for many a year. So it was a chance for me to move back up north and of course, join one of the biggest clubs in the world, which, you know, was my boyhood dream, really.
So the approach was made by who? When did you first hear a whisper that Liverpool Football Club
Well,
might be
in them days, it was a little bit that you heard through the papers, if I'm honest. You know, and clubs tended to make contact with you because they didn't want to get turned down. So you almost knew before they actually made the bid for you that they were interested in signing you. Graeme Souness was the manager. There was a bit of a new regime.
It was in transition, wasn't it?
It was, very much so. Some of the players were coming to the end of their careers and he was trying to turn the club round, and I was one of the players that he signed at the time.
Yeah, absolutely. Did you feel you were good enough to make that step? I mean, obviously, you're talking the early 90s, which a club in transition, but still the likes of Rushy, you know, Barnsley, Moulby,
some great players. Oh, yeah. I mean, some phenomenal players. And yeah, at the time, I was doing well with Spurs. And like I said, I'd broke into the England setup. So it looked, for all intents and purposes, that my career was going from strength to strength. Like I've just said to you, I was struggling with my own demons. And I was probably just at the point of self-destruct as I joined Liverpool, and for that reason, I didn't quite achieve what I would love to achieve with the club.
Yeah, fulfil your ambitions. It's all in your brand new book, Damaged. I'm just reading one of the headlines. You know, I was looking through some of the stories online about the book. Paul Stewart, I signed for Liverpool with 10 empty lager bottles on the table. That's a clear indication that at the time you knew things weren't right with yourself.
That's right. And I mean, I'd ventured into drugs as well prior to joining from Spurs, and I was on an outward spiral, if you will, of like I said, fighting my own demons and looking for answers in drink and drugs. And you know, one can't perform at the top, certainly of sport, with that going on in the background.
Did that give you sort of personality highs and lows?
Very much so.
As well? Yeah.
I think, I know I'm from Blackpool, but I was on somewhat of a rollercoaster ride, really. I didn't know, and with hindsight, it's very easy to say now that I wasn't under sort of the impression that that was the issue that I had, because I'd blocked so much out of my childhood. But you know, when I'm 53 next, and when you look back and with reflection, you know, there was a lot of contributions to why I was going off the rails.
And we'll talk about that in more detail very shortly. How easy was that to hide from, either the management team at Spurs or indeed Liverpool. You get this mega move, but you know you've got all these problems on the side as well, but you're constantly trying to hide that because you know that can't be appropriate for this sort of move in your life.
Yeah, I think back then as well, there was a bit of a drinking culture. You know, I wasn't the only one at Liverpool that liked to drink. So, you know, it was somewhat easier to hide because the game had a somewhat of a drinking culture surrounded. In sport during the 90s, you know, we had the problems with Tony Adams and Paul Merson that happened. So, you know, it was sort of a time when you'd play a game and the lads would go out and have a drink. It just so happened that I was drinking sort of daily and using.
Yeah, it was accepted, but there's a piece within the book where it's talking about Graeme Souness and saying that he knew you had a bit of a reputation as a drinker.
That's right. You
actually sat down and when you had the conversation to sign with Suey, you did that over a few beers. But a few months later, he then said, well, I knew you've got a reputation as a drinker.
Yeah, I mean, he approached me and said that he'd heard about my reputation. Of course, I denied it. Said that he was hearing things, but one does when one's in that situation, I guess. And I just totally flatly denied that I had any problem with drink.
What was the extent of the drug misuse at that time of your life?
Well, I was using cocaine and ecstasy, cocaine on a regular basis when I joined the club.
What's regular? What weekends?
Probably daily.
Right.
Probably daily, if I'm honest. The longer I was at the club, the worse it got, really.
Was it easy to access that as a footballer in the city?
Yeah. Well, it wasn't. I didn't spend my time around Liverpool. I spent most of my time around my own town. So, yeah, very easy to access, as it is these days. I mean, you know, unfortunately, you know, years and years ago, they called it, you know, the drug of the rich. But now it's so accessible, it's not right, really.
Did you constantly live in fear of that being exposed? And I am purely talking about your time at Liverpool at the moment.
Yeah.
That being exposed, you know, waking up to see a newspaper headline that said Liverpool star in drug shame.
Very much so. And I was living in fear of being pulled at training for a random drug test. But I was in a situation and in a black hole that I couldn't get out of at the time. And I'm not making excuses. I didn't know at the time that it was referring back to the problems that I had as a child. But when you think about it, I mean, we can all say, you know, when you've got a, you know, when you're older, it'd be nice to have an old head on young shoulders. Mm. But in reality, that doesn't happen. So I was just spiraling out of control the longer I went on at the club.
Would it have been obvious to your teammates? Were there some who you could literally lean on or have that conversation with? Or was that not a footballer's thing to do at that time?
No, it wasn't something that you advertised. I think towards the end of my time at the club, I think some of the players had an inkling that I was doing drugs. Just some of the comments that were made round and about the changing rooms. But I think by that time, my sort of shelf life at the club had gone. I was stuck in the reserves and without any chance of breaking into the first team.
So 42 Liverpool games, 3 goals. If you hadn't had those drink and drug issues, do you in any way look back at it and think, wow, I really could have made something of that time at Liverpool?
Do you know what? It's one of the biggest regrets of my career, my time at Liverpool, because I genuinely think, had I not gone down that road, that I could have done well for the club and gone on to play more times for England. Mm. But I didn't give myself that chance. And, you know, it's something that I have to live with that. You know, it's a regret that I have, something that I have to live with. But I do genuinely think, I mean, one can't be at his best when one's drinking and one's doing drugs at the top of sport. And you know, to be honest with you, I was at the top of sport playing for Liverpool.
Give us a proud moment wearing the Liverbird. There must be a...
Do you know what? Every time I wore it was a proud moment. I mean, to walk out and listen to them sing the song, "You'll Never Walk Alone," just tapping the sign as you walk out. Do you know, every game you had goosebumps when you walked in that, you know, walked out onto the Anfield pitch. And I was no different. So there isn't one highlight that I can say, because every time that I did manage, and like we said, it was 42, the home games were the special moments. I did score a particularly good goal in the Europa Cup, as it was called then. But Rushy outshone me and scored three, so he got all the headlines. But yeah, I remember that goal in particular.
There's a responsibility that comes with being a striker at Liverpool Football Club as well, isn't it? Particularly when you're looking across the dressing room, the old dressing room, and seeing an Ian Rush there.
Oh yeah, I mean Rushy. You know, I've said that I was fortunate to play with both Ian and Gary Lineker, and whilst they're both world class, mm-hmm. you know, I still edge Rushy as the best of the best, because it wasn't just his goal scoring prowess, but it was when he didn't have the ball and how much he frightened defenders without the ball. So when you look at them pound for pound, I think for me, Ian just shaded Gary.
Both pretty good, weren't they?
Well, they were both phenomenal. And, you know, I'm not criticising Gary in any way, but, you know, when I look at when Liverpool didn't have the ball, Rushy was our best defender at times.
The kickoff on Radio City Talk, your one stop for Merseyside sport.
This is Radio City Talk.
My guest this morning is Paul Stewart, former Spurs Liverpool striker, and we're talking about his brand new book, Damage. Now, this book is the result of the revelations that we've heard over the past 12 months, a story which shocked, really, the football world. So, Paul, just take us back to that moment where you understood that you had to reveal a secret that perhaps you thought you would hold with you until your grave.
Yeah, I was sat in my office one morning, and as I always do, I sort of go through my emails, and then I read the Mirror Online, and I saw a story on about three pages in about another former player who played in the lower divisions, who had suffered abuse at the hands of a well-known, shall we say, Northwest paedophile. I read the story and something just clicked in my mind that said I needed to come forward, because I was concerned that this lad's story would not have you know, been heard. It had been in the papers one day and gone the next. And I thought the amount of clubs that I'd played for, and big clubs, and my country, then I felt that it was right for me to come out, not just in support of him, but for all the other victims that I knew that were out there. And I did take my time over it, though, because as the book says, I hadn't even told my own immediate family. So I needed to speak to them first, my parents, not just tell them that I was going to go public, but also tell them what had happened to me. So I gave myself the weekend to discuss it with my family, but they supported me wholeheartedly in my decision to come forward. And then, of course, what ensued from there was sort of a tsunami of other victims that had fell prey to the hands of these paedophiles.
I wonder what it was that triggered you about that article, because you'd held this secret for so many decades. There must have been other moments when you'd seen stories that, if you like, touched a panic button with you. What was it at that point in time, do you think?
It genuinely was, as I've just said, it was the fact that I thought that once it had been reported on that Friday, it may never get reported again, and you know, I knew certainly from my abuser there were other victims, and I knew there were other victims of the abuser that abused Andy Woodward. So I just felt that it needed to be said, the reasons, I honestly can't tell you, but I just felt that I wasn't being true to myself if I didn't come forward and support.
What was harder for you? Talking to your family about that, or actually talking en masse to an engaged nation?
I think they were both difficult in different ways, really, because, you know, it was very difficult to have to tell my mother and father, of course, because they had no idea. They're in their late 70s now. I had to assure them that it wasn't their fault. And then I had to tell my wife and children, who don't get me wrong, they'd seen that I'd had problems with drink and drugs over the years, and knew that my wife knew that there's something wasn't quite right in my childhood, but I'd never shared the secret that I shared, first of all, with the national press.
And what was that moment like where you spoke to your wife?
It was difficult. I think emotionally I was shot then, because I'd made my mind up to tell the story. And I blocked, you know, when we talk about 41 years, I'd blocked this out. And I know it manifested itself in many different ways, but she had an inkling that I had a problem in my childhood. So, you know, I think it was a shock, but, you know, it was one of them things that was never spoken about in the house. So I was more concerned really for them, because I knew that we were going to be thrust back into the sort of headlines, and I'd been out of the game for so long. And my wife isn't somebody that really likes to be at the forefront of anything like that. So I was, you know, I had to ask and tell them that this was going to be what I wanted to do, but make sure that they were comfortable in me doing it, knowing that, you know, I was going to be all over the papers and on national TV.
And the result of that has been this book, Damage. Has this been a bit of a release for you?
Well, I was never going to write an autobiography, and we've chatted about some of the great players at Liverpool, like Ian Rush and Robbie Fowler and Michael Owen. You know, I believe players like them, and rightly so, write autobiographies, because, you know, the success that they've had in their careers warrants such a book. Mine was a little bit different. I think I overachieved as a player. I didn't think that my football career warranted an autobiography. But, of course, that all changed in November 2016 when I told my story. And I do think then I had a story to tell. And I don't know whether you've read a lot of the book, but you can see that it's not an autobiography.
No.
It's more of a life story. And,
yeah.
And, you know, it probably gave me a chance to write down everything that has compounded itself in the 41 years since I was abused.
This is Radio City Talk.
Rock, sport and talk for Liverpool.
Okay, let's continue our chat with Paul Stewart. His new book, Damage, My Story, is out. And we were talking off air. We were saying it's not an autobiography. There are some football stories in there, but it's a deep thinking book about his own personal reflections of his battle with drink, drugs, and of course abuse from an early age. Take us back to the very beginning. Your mum and dad, Herbert and Joyce, and that family life as a young lad. Was a footballer all you wanted to be, Paul?
Yeah. I was born in Withenshaw off a council estate, and really football was our only release. Ever since I can remember, I was kicking a ball and dreamed of becoming a professional footballer. And unfortunately, we came across a coach at the time who used that tool to sort of get all the kids, if you will. And I was one that he targeted, he groomed not just myself but my parents, subjected me to abuse for 4 years, from the age of 11 to 15.
So you say groomed yourself and your parents. He groomed the environment, the situation, to make
the
sure
situation.
It suited himself.
Yeah, as I've stated in the book, you know, I was an 11-year-old child, if you will, and he threatened to kill my parents and my brothers if I said anything. He also said that it was something you had to do if you wanted to be a footballer. When he was around my parents, he was giving them gifts, which you can imagine, being from a council estate in Withenshaw, we weren't blessed with a lot of money. So to them, he was like a long lost uncle. To me, it was just fear, and you know, I had nowhere to turn. I didn't feel I had anywhere to turn. I didn't want to say anything to my parents, because I know my dad would have done something. I felt that, I was trapped in a way. I, as I've stated in the book, there was almost a year where I fell silent and didn't speak, going from a happy-go-lucky child to somebody that didn't say a word. So, you know, when I look back, that was maybe a cry for help. But, you know, these are very manipulative people, and the way in which they manipulate the circumstances that they're in, it is awful. But, you know, on reflection, maybe I should have said something. I mean, even when I became a teenager playing at Blackpool, I sort of regret that I never, because he ended up as a scout for the club. I sort of regret I never said anything then, because people have used words like brave and courageous about my choice in coming forward now, but I don't see it as that. I think that if I'd have probably said something as a young footballer at Blackpool, I could have maybe stopped him accessing and doing the same to other children, which he did.
Was there no way to actually get away from him?
No.
As a coach, to move to a different coach? Do you ever recollect a time where you thought, you know, you could press for the situation to be changed?
No, he was at the house all the time. He was bringing gifts, as I said. He would make excuses that he needed to take me for extra training to get me alone. I didn't feel that there was a situation that I could say anything, get out of. And like I say, these people are very manipulative, and you know, for all intents and purposes, he'd be sat there like a long lost uncle with my family, whilst they're putting the fear of God in me.
Did you feel you were the only one subjected to this?
I was at the time, because I was with him 24/7. Mm. He made sure that, you know, he was waiting outside the school gates at home time for me. If he wasn't at the school gates, he was at my house. He always made sure that he dropped me off last when we went training, so he could get me alone. I just didn't feel that I had anywhere to turn in reality.
Did he brainwash you? Brainwashed you? Is that a correct description of what was going on there?
I don't know. It's very difficult. Having spoken to other victims, this seems to be the MO of these certainly the ones that played around football at the time. You know, they give you a dream of making it as a professional, and also the threat of taking that away. And when all you want to do is be a footballer, then sometimes, you know, the other doesn't seem so bad, especially when, you know, you come from a relatively poor background, and this person is bringing gifts and things that your family can't afford. You know, they, like I say, they're very, very clever in the way that they do this.
You speak in the book about making your professional debut. Was that an important moment for you? Did you think things would change for you at that point?
Yeah, I they did. There's no doubt that they did. I mean, I think I was 17 when I made the debut. Mm. I'd just turned 16. I was focused totally on my career. Like I said,
how were you in your head at that point?
I think I was good, you know. Yeah. But when I look back and reflect back, I was never really good. I was maybe seen as somewhat arrogant, somewhat conceited, but I just decided that, you know, if I just focus on my career, then I can forget anything else that has happened in my life. The unfortunate thing was I had to face this man around the club, because he'd become an integral part of Blackpool Football Club at the time when I was making my way in the game. And this is why I say to you, you know, one of the biggest regrets is because I should have gone to a coach or a manager and said something at the time. But I just felt that they maybe would see me as some sort of a problem child, somebody that's trying to cause an issue. And of course, back in them days, this abuse wasn't spoken about as much as it is now, since we've come forward in the 21st century. Yeah. You know, it was almost swept under the carpet, if you will.
So you were saying you were feeling pretty good about yourself, 17 years old, and of course, you did go on to become a pretty prolific striker.
Mm.
Thinking back, did you do that against all odds? Or how was it, because it became tunnel vision for you?
I don't think I did it against all odds, because, you know, I just had the ethics that I wanted to work as hard as I could to make that dream happen. I did often think about what had happened to me in the past, but I just put it to one side and just thought, if I work as hard as I possibly can, then I have a chance of reaching my dream, and maybe thinking that I'll end up forgetting all that. I'll end up forgetting what happened to me as a child. But
so you tried to blanket the whole
thing. The whole lot. I just sort of put it in a box and thought that I'd parked it in my head, if you will, not realising, because, like I say, I was young and not as, I don't have the head on me as a child that I have now. And then when I look back and realised what I was like and what I got up to, I can see that it did affect me in a big way.
And there was never an idea that other people around you, even when you were a young professional, had sort of identified the man at the heart of this, and you never thought to yourself, someone else has noticed that this guy is, there's some problems with this guy.
No, and you know what, when I look back, I do think, how could they not see? How can somebody not recognise that a child has changed in his demeanour, in how he was? All of a sudden, you're a happy-go-lucky child into somebody that's withdrawn and not speaking. But I didn't realise that as a child. I didn't think that as a child. I just felt trapped and didn't see a way out. So the only way out for me was focus on football and making it in the game.
You had some good spells in your football career. At Man City, you scored 30 goals in one season. That's obviously right. A high for you.
Yeah, I had a great time. And, you know, a lot of people seem to think that I may have started my career at Manchester City, but in truth, I was only there sort of a season and 3 months. Mm. We went down out of the old First Division in the first season, and the second season I managed to score 30 goals. But it was one of them seasons where whatever you did, everything seemed to go in. And obviously it sparked a lot of interest from other clubs, and Tottenham being one of them.
Unfortunately, they never clocked that you were a United fan as well.
No, I never mentioned
it. City fans at the time. That's
Do you know
surprise,
what? That was one thing I never mentioned. I have recently, but I thought it was best kept quiet.
The Tottenham move, though, that's an interesting one. And obviously, a great friendship, as you still have now with Gazza.
Yeah, I mean, I still speak to Paul. I mean, Paul is fighting his own demons, as we know. I tend to speak to Paul when he's on the other side of drink, unfortunately. But I've spoken to him recently, and he was, on the good side of drink, shall we say. And we had some good times together, because I signed on a Saturday and he signed on a Sunday, and we were sort of thrown together straight away. So, I didn't realise some of the issues that he had, because, again, I was a young lad, and, the bulimia and the OCD, it sort of wasn't widely reported then. I mean, and I was growing up as well. So I just thought, it's just Gazza. And then, of course, as you get older and you see the problems that he's had and it's reported, you realise then, God, that was what he was like when we were there. But he did so many good things on the pitch. You just sort of put the other stuff to one side, if you know what I mean, because he was magical on the pitch.
Off the pitch, how bad was he in terms of going to extremes?
He was going to extremes where he was eating and then making himself sick because he didn't want to put weight on. Often we would set off for training or for a game. We'd have to go back and he'd check the door a number of times, look at the the TV. He had to have the control facing exactly there. But I was just like, Gazza, come on, we're going to be late. I had no idea that these were real issues that obviously were highlighted later on.
One of the biggest moments of your life, an FA Cup final. Tottenham against Nottingham Forest. You detail this 1991. So you've done a chapter on this in the book. That's the pinnacle, isn't it? I think particularly as a footballer in the 80s, 90s, the FA Cup still held that esteem. Do you look back to that sort of day and think, wow, I really did get there?
Well, I think that particular chapter, if you read that chapter in its entirety, is quite monumental for me in a sense that we had. Obviously, the Clough and Gascoigne final at the time. Brian Clough had never won the FA Cup, and Gazza was leaving for Lazio, but Gazza also got injured in the game. And I remember distinctly being on the pitch and everything coming back to me at what I'd gone through in my life to get to that place. And I thought, you know, I might never get here again, so I'm going to give it my best. And hopefully, you know, which happened, I managed to score a goal and get man of the match, and we won the game. But, you know, I had this moment of, you know, everything I've been through, everything I've worked for, because Paul's going off, I'm not going to give this chance up. And I gave it everything I got to help us win the cup that year.
Paul, there's some remarkable highs and lows in the book. As you say, your Liverpool career never quite panned out as you would have hoped. But as you said then, you had some amazing times in football. But the book is deep. It's fascinating as well. It's definitely your story. And at the back of it, there's a page on, or a couple of pages, on SAVE, Safeguarding and Victim Engagement. It was born in December 2016, set up by yourself, Ian Ackley, David White and Derek Bell. And you're still working hard with this now.
Yes, I mean, it is something that that I'm very passionate about, purely and simply because, you know, I want to make sure that what happened in the 70s, 80s and 90s doesn't happen to our young aspiring footballers again. And what we're trying to do, not just at professional level, but at grassroots level, is make sure that safeguarding surrounding our children is at the best it can be. And we're working towards that with the FA, with the governing bodies, and hopefully we'll get to a point where it is very difficult for these people to access our children.
The Kickoff with Steve Hothersall on Radio City Talk.